Good morning. Shall we start? Dr. Jones tells me that when he left Cooperstown Sunday, it was snowing. We aren't going to be able to provide him any snow down here, but we can sort of chill him anyway, if not with the real weather, with our air conditioning. I won't even try to introduce him again. I'll just say, here he is.
Last night I talked about criminal trials and criminal materials as sources of information for the social historian or the student of folk culture. Today I'm going to talk about what, for want of a better word in this country, we have called folk art. I'm not entirely satisfied with this word, with this term, though I don't really know a completely satisfactory one. It's a kind of tent word under which a great many different things are collected. I think that probably I would prefer the adjective naive to folk, because I think it's more accurate and it's more helpful when you're talking to Europeans. Folk art to a European means the highly decorative, stylized, repetitive patterns, which we think of in terms of Pennsylvania German paintings, for example, of Pennsylvania German decorative arts. I found in Europe a few years ago, Mrs. Jones and I were there, among other things, looking for just this kind of painting, that we got along better with European scholars. And we found in Mexico and Guatemala that we get along better if we use the word naive. And naive is a perfectly good word. It's self-explanatory. But we're rather committed to the word folk art. Two of the major collections in the country have used the term now for 15 years. That's the Abby Aldrich Rockefeller Folk Art Collection in Colonial Williamsburg and our folk art collection at Cooperstown. So, with all of its handicaps, let me define the term as I'm using it this morning. Folk art in America, by and large, was created for a public only vaguely aware of the academic tradition, which our more highly trained artists followed. This was a public which, by the time of the Civil War and after that, tended to prefer daguerreotypes, chromos, and courier knives prints. In other words, this was a public unaware of the great art tradition, unaccustomed to seeing paintings by trained artists, who accepted this art because it was the art they knew, and it was what they were accustomed to. The artists were often skilled craftsmen. They were trained as sign or wagon painters, as decorators, as wood carvers or tinsmiths. In other words, instead of going to an academic tradition, they had gone to a craft tradition. Some served for a short time under academic artists, men who had had training in the great European tradition, and one of these craft-trained fellows would go and serve for 3 months or 6 months or even maybe a year. And this would improve, but not entirely change their painting. As a matter of fact, most of the great early painters, Gilbert Stuart, West, Trumbull, all went through an early period in which they were craftsman painters. And then got, after that, a good deal of academic training. And many of our American painters went to England to study with Benjamin West, well, with Gilbert Stuart. I think it's a matter of some interest to us that Gilbert Stuart, who was born and raised on our own frontier, went to England to become president of the Royal Academy. Well, as I say, some served briefly under academic artists. Some were ranked. Some of the producers, some of the artists who created this material that we think of as folk art, were school children or rank amateurs. Every every girls' school had classes in watercolor, in drawing, and some in painting itself, in oil paint. Every military academy had drawing taught, just as today it might be necessary in a military school to teach photography. So the early military training included field sketching and watercolors. These people often had a real artistic ability, but they lacked contact with the tradition of Western art, as taught in the studios and academies of Europe, or they knew this tradition only through prints and engravings. The emphasis here is on what the artist has to say rather than how he says it. He's full of his subject. And in terms of the academic art of his own time, is very limited. It's content rather than style. The result is often a sharp, clear, and unsentimental view of life. It's life as it was, not as someone wished it was. Compare, for example, the kinds of portraits I'm going to show you in a few minutes with the court tradition of painting, where the emphasis is on the grandeur of costume, the jewelry. The emphasis is on the quality of textile and the light as it plays across the textile, as compared with the emphasis on the face, perhaps with warts and wens, perhaps with all sorts of physical deformities. But be that as it may, it is the way the artist saw the sitter, and there was nothing in the tradition of these sitters to make them feel that the artist ought to paint them other than they were. The content and the ideas then outrun the technique or the command of the materials. The subject matter, and this is one of the great differences between the folk artist and the academic artist, the subject matter is commonplace. It's the middle and lower class, but it has a marvelous quality of vigor, of inventiveness, of vitality. The good, one of the questions that as one works along with this material is, well, it's folk, all right, but is it art? Well, one of the things that differentiates between whether it's good folk art or bad folk art is whether it has this quality of vitality, whether it has guts. The emphasis is often on detail, on the specific, on the accretion of details, rather than on the broad sweep, rather than on the total design. The emphasis is on color rather than light. Think, for example, of a Winslow Homer, for example, where you are almost unconscious of color, but you are very conscious of light and the way light plays, the way the artist shows the light playing on the canvas. The emphasis is on line rather than structure and volume, so that you have a kind of two-dimensional rather than three-dimensional quality. The color fills in the form, and the color is intellectually determined. But the composition as a whole is instinctive. And this is one of the things I find very interesting about this material, that very often the total composition is very exciting, very inventive, very original. And those of you who move easily in contemporary art and the art of the last 50 years will, I think, find many interesting relationships. We first became aware of these collections in New England, New York, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey. I think the answer to this is that there were, first of all, antiquarians who were interested in these materials for genealogical reasons. People began to look at the portraits because they were interested in genealogy and family history. Then, two, artists in Europe. Picasso, for example, had been tremendously impressed by a small group of American folk art taken to Europe about 1925. And then a few people began to collect. Mrs. John D. Rockefeller Jr., for example, began with the help of two people, Edith Halpert, the dealer in New York City, and a scholar named Holger Cahill, to make her collection, which is the core and basis of the folk art collection at Colonial Williamsburg. Ohio, Indiana, Michigan, and Virginia began to be conscious of their folk art. There is every reason in my mind to believe that there is a great deal more of it in the South than anybody has proved yet. I think it's here. I think it has not been looked for in the right places. You know, you only see what you're looking for. In my early years as a folklorist, I was out looking primarily for materials about witchcraft and ghost lore. I never looked at what was on the walls of the houses where I was collecting. It was not until years later that I realized that there probably were in those houses all sorts of things that my untrained eye did not see. About 10 or 12 years ago, Mrs. Nina Fletcher Little, who is one of the great authorities in this field, said to me, "Why is it that we have so much stencil, early 19th century, stenciled walls and painted walls, that is, painted with pictures, in New England, and you don't have them in New York State?" Well, I think that I made up some very interesting reasons why we didn't have them. And about 3 months later, we began to find stenciled walls, and within a matter of a year, we had found about 20 buildings within easy driving distance of Cooperstown with stenciled walls, and within a year, we had found a house in which every single wall had had freehand paintings, waterfalls and Indians and gentlemen getting onto boats and steamboats and everything under the sun. And if you'd like to see that, sometime when you go to Winterthur Museum in Winterthur, Delaware, you will see about half of those walls nicely cleaned up and moved down and part of that museum. In other words, what I'm saying is you find what you're looking for. And one of the things that I hope to do today is to call the attention of those of you whose homes are in the South and whose roots are here to go back into your own communities and look for the kind of thing I'm going to show you. I believe it's here, and I believe that the people who have come in from the outside haven't found it because they haven't known where to look. And I think you will know where to look once you start seeing them. I think, for example, that in the small, bad, confused local historical societies, those community attics that I spoke of the other day, there may be an infinite number of pictures that are very important to find. They are probably dirty beyond all measure. They may be difficult to see and difficult to photograph, therefore. They may be in stacks in the attic. They may be scorned by the little old lady who has been curator since 1905. But what I'm hoping to do is to give you the first inklings of the kind of eye that recognizes in the confusions of such a place the values that may be there. You are more likely to find these in villages that have not been cursed by modern progress. The kind of place where people live in the same houses as their grandparents lived. You will find them in villages or cities that were prosperous in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s. You will find them in families that were not rich enough to replace those old pictures with nice new ones. who it never occurred to them to take down the rather ugly paintings of their ancestors, partly because they're their ancestors, and partly because they didn't have enough money to put anything in their place. You will find them in crummy little antique shops. You will find them in country auctions. Now, I am jumping at a certain number of conclusions. I am, in general, jumping at conclusions that you will find them essentially in the same kind of place that we find them in our part of the world, whether you found them in Indiana or they have found them in Ohio and Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania and New England are slightly different problems. But I think the rules of thumb that I give you will be applicable. I would like to see a few little exhibits here and there in the South. I think once you start publicizing, once one town gets together 20 of these pictures, or even 12 of them, and shows them in the public library, that others will come out of their hiding places. My wife, who is the better scholar in this field than I am, has a kind of, if you pardon my saying so, a kind of marvelous bird dog quality about this sort of thing. I remember one evening we were looking for the work of a particular painter, and I might say that we never did find it in that community. But people said to us, well, there aren't any paintings in such and such a town of about 350 people. We went in there, and in about an hour, she had found one of the great masterpieces in this field. And then, this was 5:30, by 7:30, we had turned up another 12 portraits of sufficient quality so that we photographed them and put them into our files. And this led ultimately to important discoveries in the whole area. And yet this is an area where people said, well, there aren't any paintings there. Well, I don't believe it. And I have seen what experience and judgment and a kind of undying confidence that you can't be wrong can produce. Well, before I go on and do a lot of talking, let's look at some of these things. And if we could turn out the lights wherever they are. Are they over? Oh, they're all back there. There's no sense in talking. I think you girls over here are probably going to have trouble seeing. Are you? Are you online? All right, fine. I'm going to start with a group of paintings that are patriotic in theme. Most of these paintings, unless I say so, are from our collections at Cooperstown. One could illustrate them as well by the Garbage collection, the Colonel Garbage's collection at the National Gallery. One could illustrate them from the collection at Colonial Williamsburg, but these are paintings I happen to know better. This is an interesting example of the infinite variety of patriotic, could we focus that a little, please? Of patriotic paintings that came beginning with the death of Washington and right through the Jackson administration. There was a great upsurge that those of you in American history will recognize as the whole rising tide of nationalism, and you see it in the art, and it germinates around Washington and the Washington cult that developed immediately after his death. One of the things I like about this is that it has so many of the national symbols, the Liberty Cap, the pine tree, the flag, the eagle, General Washington himself, and then, for good measure, Columbia, or Liberty, is stepping on the British crown. You'll notice, again, what I said before, that the ideas outrun the technique. He had a little trouble with anatomy, but the ideas were all there. The next one is exactly the same theme, except that Columbia is feeding the eagle from her chalice. Both of these paintings derive originally from a print by a sophisticated artist, a print that must have been repeated a good many times, because I have published, I think, 25 different versions of this Liberty or Columbia with the eagle, and I suppose I have in my files another 50 examples. It was one of the great popular themes, and one that I think quite likely you not only might find in this period, that is the first 30 years of the 19th century, but you might well find it in the war or after the Civil War years, translated into Confederate terms. Now the next slide is a later picture of a mid-19th century painting of Washington at the Battle of Princeton. When I spoke of vigor and vitality, replacing or substituting for technique, I think you see what I mean. It's all there, the blood and the wounds and the dead man, and then there's General Washington coming out of that burst of smoke, which actually was part of the tradition of that battle, that the men had started to retreat, you remember, and there was a great cloud of gun smoke, and suddenly Washington appeared, and with that remarkable facility he had for profanity, he suggested that they return to the battle. The patriotic theme, not only at the time, but after the time. This comes well in the mid-century. Next, please. Now, this is much later. One of the points I want to make, that the work of the naive painter did not stop with the photograph, with photography. It went on, and as a matter of fact, one of the things we've been very interested in is the naive painter in the 20th century. And every once in a while, we turn up or get in touch with, discover a new Grandma Moses or a new primitive who is working in our own time. Now, this is an artist named J.O.J. Frost from Marblehead, Massachusetts. He was a local handyman and restaurant keeper. And at about 65, his wife died, and he lived alone, and he began painting the local history which he'd read all his life. And this is Colonel Glover going off to the Revolution with the fishermen of Marblehead. It's a marvelous picture with its repetitive patterns. And those characteristically wild clouds and trees such as never were anywhere. You're going to see those trees, that same kind of treatment of trees, over and over again this morning. The next painting is a political banner. Now this is all on canvas, and this canvas was then sewed onto a great silken square and carried in the streets for a political campaign. This was for the campaign of, it was for a political meeting in central New York when Henry Clay came to visit in 1839. Painted by the local sign painter, who also could do you a portrait or paint your wagon or put a picture on the glass in your clock or put a window in your house if that broke. We know a good deal about this man Kennedy because we have his advertisements. And then when they wrote the history of his county, he wrote the chapter on the artists in the county, and I think it will please you to know that the chapter on the artists runs for about 2,000 words, and about 1,850 are about the distinguished painter, Mr. Kennedy. but again, here are all of the political symbols of Clay's party. Internal reform, the flag, progress. Down at the bottom, hard to see, are an anvil and a plow. Internal improvements, and so on. Later on, we're going to see a picture of the kind of shop in which this was painted. Just remember it for later reference. Now, the last painting in this group of patriotic pictures is a little sketch of the Battle of Silver Creek in Virginia. My guess about this is that it was probably painted by a young officer who had had art training as part of his military training. It again is a pencil sketch that has been painted in. It's a small painting, and far better than most of the paintings of the Civil War. I don't know what you will find here. Relatively little has come to light, but most of it in our end of the country is extremely bad. It's sometimes interesting, but it is totally lacking in any aesthetic pleasure. We now turn to a couple of examples of religious art. There has never been the great body of religious art in this country that you find in Europe or that you find in the Catholic countries. Largely, I think, because there was a kind of there was, of course, a taboo in many Protestant sects against anything that they could interpret as an image, and a painting was an image. But there is a small, quite interesting body of religious paintings, much of it based upon the illustrations in Bibles, the woodcuts and engravings in Bibles. Now, this is one of two paintings that I'm going to show you by a Quaker painter named Edward Hicks. I suppose perhaps one of the two or three greatest of our folk artists. As a Quaker, he felt that painting was wrong, but as a Quaker, he felt also that there was something he had to say, and his method of speaking was with the paintbrush, because he was trained as a sign painter, as a carriage painter. So he, over and over again, more than 90 times, he painted this sermon that the lion and the lamb shall lie down together. And here you see them lying down together, and in the distance is William Penn signing his treaty with the Indians. I think it's just about the only treaty with the Indians we didn't break. This is an interesting painting, partly because of the rhyme that he's put around the edges. Now let's look at the next one, which, as again you'll see, is exactly the same theme, but from an artistic point of view, an aesthetic point of view, I think a much more interesting one. Again you see Penn and the Indian back in the corner. Now that little business of Penn and the Indian is based on an engraving of Benjamin West's painting of the same theme. And the animals, too, come from engravings and woodcuts of animals in Bibles with which Hicks was familiar. My wife likes to point out when she uses this slide that the lion looked as though he was going to be able to hold on to himself just another minute or two. That he's heading for either ulcers or that lamb. And I think that maybe the lion reflects to a certain extent the conflict that poor Hicks himself was going through. Now, we're going to look at a group of portraits, starting with the next picture. And the portraits are, by all means, the commonest of the pictures that have come down to us. And I think this partly is because families have tended to hang on to portraits of their ancestors out of family decency, when they, even after the tides of taste had changed, even during the long period when paintings of this sort not only were not respected or interesting or accepted, but when they were actually considered in very bad taste, or even worse, were not noticed, were not seen. This little boy, painted in 1784 with his little bow and arrow, it's a marvelously decorative piece. I mean, it's all, you notice it balances side for side, as happens so often in the with the naive painter's work. The two sides will balance out. The next one is a pastel, quite early, probably 1800, 1810. It has more action than you usually find in these paintings, more action than you usually find in the pastel. Notice the doll. And the little beads, the little gold beads, the little girl on the right is, on the right is wearing. Next. This is a painting with a good deal of interest for a variety of reasons, I think. It's by a man named John Brewster. We often don't know these artists. They didn't often did not sign their work. And they left no clues. John Brewster did sign his work on the top of the stretcher, the wooden piece at the back. Almost always signed them. He was a deaf mute. And he was, like many of these artists, but by no means like all of them, an itinerant artist. In other words, he had a wagon and went from town to town painting such pictures as he could get to paint. Most of these would be portraits, but his advertisements, like the work, like the advertisements of so many of his contemporaries, advertised that he could do chairs, he could paint picture frames, he could paint pictures on glass. He could do signs and so on. This little painting of which we call One Shoe Off didn't start that way. When you may notice that if you look at the bare foot, there's a little pink business down here. And when he painted it first, he had a shoe on. If you see it under a microscope, you can see just. It was a shoe that came out just like this. Why he took the shoe off and put it in the child's hand, I haven't any idea. I'm always interested in portraits of children because artists tell me that they are so difficult to do. And yet the early painters, these primitive artists, were constantly painting children's portraits. I suppose this is what the market was. But they're hard to paint. Notice one or two nice little things, the way he has picked up the bow on the shoe in the stenciling on the floor. That is stenciling, I'm very certain. It might possibly be a painted canvas rug, but I think not. The high-cut gown dates it about 1808, 1805, somewhere in there. There are now, I suppose, 50 paintings by Brewster known, or a number in Williamsburg, and another all over the New England territory. Next. When I spoke of vigor and vitality, this is what I meant. When we got this painting, it seemed almost immediately that everybody in the museum started calling him Butch. Notice the costume with its long jacket and its almost pantaloons. The clothing of young children did not differentiate very much between boys and girls until quite late, until the 30s. It's an interesting costume with its lace collar, and it's and I have never seen, nor have any of my friends who are costume specialists, seen exactly this kind of clothes pattern. Nice table, probably grained, that is, painted to look like a wood, which it isn't. Painted in this instance to look like cherry. Next. This is a painting that I'm very interested in, for a variety of reasons. How old would you say that woman is?
Thirty-five.
Is that about right? She was 18. One of the things that Mrs. Trollope mentions in her book on America, Mrs. Trollope, you remember, is an English woman who came over here and lived in Cincinnati for a while and had a business there which failed, but traveled a good deal and wrote a very interesting, not entirely complimentary book about this country. She speaks of the fierceness of the women's countenances, how often they look dour and glum. And this you often see in the portrait. I don't know what the answer is. I think partly it was a hard life, and it was a life with a good many fears for women that women in our time just don't suffer from. The terrible loss and the constant loss of women from puerperal fever, which was worse here for some reason than it was in Europe, so that very often a woman died with her first childbirth. This kind of fear and others, and yet these were a far more independent breed of women than were to be seen in Europe. Mrs. Trollope mentions with awe the fact that American women traveled anywhere they wanted to alone, that she was constantly running across women riding on horseback alone from one town to another. There are two portraits of this woman's mother and father at the Rockefeller Folk Art Collection, Williamsburg. Let's try the next one. I sincerely dislike this woman, and I'm not showing you her husband, but I dislike him more. The reason I'm showing it is because I have said to you, and will try to emphasize this from time to time, that very often these paintings are remarkably interesting documents. Some of you may be familiar with an American ballad called Fair Charlotte. It's about a girl who goes to a dance in the northern part of the country and does not dress warmly enough and freezes to death on the way home. One of the reasons she froze to death was because she didn't wear enough underclothing. There was a period about 1800 to 1812 when American girls were wearing remarkably flimsy clothing, and one of the tricks of the trade, if you'll pardon the expression, was to wear brightly colored striped underwear, which was then dampened so that it clung very closely to the body. And this is the first time, the only time I've ever seen evidence of just what I'm talking about. Underneath her rather transparent dress is this striped underwear, which made such a horrified so many mothers and fathers and grandmothers of the period. And there is a whole kind of body of literature at a folk level of mothers warning their daughters not to go around that way, or they die of the cold, if nothing else. Interesting details of the decorative arts here. I think this was painted by her husband, who was, I would be willing to bet, an interior decorator along with his portrait work. Originally her arm came down here, but he moved it, and I think to show the kind of chair decorating that he could do, and the kind of wall decorating that he was capable of. Next. Well, this is a charming picture, I think. It's very much like a Modiglione, isn't it? And how much better the mother is than the child. The little brat probably was wiggling all the time. But here is a painting where the artist may well have had more training. He may have put in an apprenticeship for a while with a more academically trained artist. that little corner of a window where the view outside is very is a tradition which had probably come to this country in prints of European painters. And we get it all through the 18th and early 19th century. Next. I'm very fond of this picture for purely decorative purposes, for decorative reasons. I said to you earlier that there was often an instinctive sense of composition, which I think this portrait exemplifies. It's a, they're never, never flowers and never, never cats, but the total effect is extremely charming. Next. Now this is a painting by a man who, with his brothers, with his brothers-in-law and sons and nephew, had a what they called a printing garret in Boston, a man named Matthew Pryor, or William Matthew Pryor. Again, we have their advertisements. And he would do a portrait of a single person without shadows, complete with the frame for $2.50 on up. If you wanted a lot of shadows and a lot of jewelry and fancy clothes, fine, but it cost you more. And it might cost you as much as $25. A little double portrait like this of two children, again, without much depth, you notice. It's really very two-dimensional. You feel they're sort of flat children. Would run about $5. He also did landscapes, but always landscapes based upon prints. One of his popular items was George Washington's grave, which he did over and over again. Next. Now this is an interesting painting for a number of reasons, partly because its companion portrait, the one of her husband, also has a musical, and he has a flute in his hand, and she has a music book. Some years ago, I went through a collection of a group of our paintings, which we just acquired, with two very dear friends of ours, who are both pediatricians. Looking at these paintings, particularly the paintings of children, for medical problems. We noticed that a remarkably large number of the children and a number of the adults had this curious line here. Notice it? Between the eye and the brow. And Dr. Goodwin looked at these and he said, that is remarkable evidence of rickets. This is absolute proof that this child had as a baby suffered from rickets, and this global business in the forehead developed. This meant there wasn't enough orange juice. There weren't the proper balance of vitamins in the baby's diet. But the percentage of these children that suffered from rickets is very high. And this, mind you, probably it's safe to say that these were the favored children. These were children in families that could afford to have a painting painted. Next. There's a painting by a painter named Davis. You notice again that perfect balance. Daddy on one side, Mama on the other. The hat is balanced with the flowers. This loop comes like this. The rug is a repetitive pattern. Notice these are very gaily decorated chairs. And the child on her lap. This is probably a painted canvas rug. Davis did hundreds of these. He was a kind of drunken ne'er-do-well in the little town in which he lived. And in the spring, when sensible men were getting their plowing done, he would pack up and go off and paint pictures. Next. I thought this might interest you. Not all of the itinerant painters were men. This is a painting by a woman named Goldsmith, who lived in central New York, wandered all over the countryside. Her paintings have been found over an area of 150 miles. She would come into a town and just set up business like any other itinerant. I think it's rather nice to think that ultimately she did marry one of her sitters. But I am as certain as I can be of anything that there were not only painters who came out of New England and painted in the plantations and the small towns in the South, but I am perfectly willing to bet you any amount of money that if you look hard enough, you're going to find native painters who were doing the same thing. I see no reason in the structure of the society why there wouldn't have been itinerants, why there wouldn't have been native painters of the caliber that I've been showing you. Next. This is Martha Barnes at the age of, I think, 92, smoking her pipe. The idea that nice women didn't smoke was one of the cliches of the later 19th century. But all kinds of decent women smoked in the early 19th century. Well, decent and indecent. One of the murders that I suggested last night, the Whipple Strang case, the young wife was sitting by the fire smoking her pipe while her lover went upstairs and shot her husband. Martha Barnes, there are a whole group of pictures of Martha. She's always smoking her clay pipe. My great-grandmother smoked a pipe. They did not, as near as I can make out, smoke cheroots or what are they called, tamperellos, but they did smoke a pipe. Next. It's fearful and wonderful, isn't it? It certainly would cause you to be hesitant about having children. And yet, you know, the more you look at the darn thing, the more it sort of gets to you. Sure, I'm purely in terms of composition. I think it may be a reflection of the beginnings of photography. I think it may be in the mid-40s. This business of staying out of the picture and holding the baby up. Also, the sleeves indicate about that date. But you know, it's not so far from some of the portraits of the more cockeyed painters of our own time. Really? Well, let's go on. We've had enough of that. I'm going to show you a few landscapes. Those of you that know the work of Paul Klee and the modern painters with their total distortion of perspective don't find something of this sort as startling as those of you who have thought only in terms of perspective in the 18th century, well, the Renaissance sense of artistic perspective. Over and over again, these artists were trying to deal in a medium without having one of the trade secrets, which was the training in perspective. The effect is cluttered, and yet aesthetically satisfying, partly, I think, because of the use of the repetitive patterns. This reiteration that you get in here of the trees, and then caught up over here. Whoever HBC was, she put a title on it, Rural Life, painted by HBC, and for our infinite pleasure, dated it 1853. One of the things that interests me is the number of fences and the different kinds of fences. And the fact that the houses do not have blinds. One of the questions we're often wondering about is what houses had window blinds and which ones didn't and when. Well, here is a house of 1853, probably a New England house, without. Next. I'm afraid you can't see much of that. It's a painting that, again, has this distorted perspective, but a great deal of interesting detail. This is a lumber mill. And if you could prowl around in the painting itself, you'd see teams of oxen and a little railroad train and all sorts of things. I don't know where that's from. I rather suspect it may be from farther west, perhaps Wisconsin or Michigan. Next. This is by an artist named Seifert. He was a young German who came to Wisconsin in the, probably early 70s to avoid conscription in Germany. He had had a reasonably good education. He had had probably some art training, some painting training as a schoolboy. He was a taxidermist, and he had a little truck garden, and painted farm portraits of farms on the side. He did probably a great many of them. We have three in our collection, and there are others. I think this is in many ways the best of them. It's very like Swiss countryside paintings being done about the same time. And one of the points I want to emphasize is that while we have many examples of this in America, I think that all over Western Europe, and we know that all over Mexico and in Guatemala, I speak of these places because I have been there and seen them, there were painters of this same general caste, the same lack of technical training, but the same enthusiasm, who were functioning in those countries. It's not an American phenomenon. It's an international phenomenon of the 19th century. Next. Every once in a while, one of these artists gives you a kind of emotional impact in his painting that is delightful and perhaps unexpected. There is about this bleak, cold, forsaken scene that I find emotionally stirring and emotionally depressing. I think part of this is achieved by what seems to be snow inside the church. One of the things that gives this painting its emphasis and its strength are those two magnificent horses that look like Etruscan horses, right off an Etruscan vase. But it's a very successful painting with the way this road carries you on out of town. Perhaps to a house where it's going to be a little warmer, where maybe there'll be a noggin of something if you ask for it politely. Next. I would think that down in places like Savannah and all along the coast, the sea coast, you would find this kind of painting, the portrait of a ship. This is one by James Bard, who with his brother did portraits of Hudson River steamboats. And the captains and the owners were constant purchasers of these portraits of ships. And I would be willing to bet you anything that in Savannah, as in Charleston, there will be this kind of painting up in the attic, perhaps, back in the storage room of the Historical Society, but it'll be there. And it'll be by local artists. This is a kind of international thing. We found paintings of this sort in Norway and in Sweden, all over the Maritime North. Next. This is a purely decorative thing. This is what we call a fireboard, a board placed in front of a fireplace in the summertime. And it's the title of it is The Castle of Montgomery. But it's obviously just sheer romantic fantasy. Next. At first it looks like a sheer abstraction, doesn't it? But it isn't. No? Oh, yes, it is upside down. I'm sorry. It doesn't make a great deal of difference. There we are. This is a Colonial Williamsburg, and it's a map of a gentleman's estate in Kingston, New York. But I know of letters to a New York painter named Matthews from a plantation owner in South Carolina asking him to do this kind of painting of his plantation. And the owner drew out a little sketch of what he wanted. And I would be willing to bet you that this kind of combination of map and portrait and houses, gardens and so on, are probably to be found in this part of the world. I don't think you'll find them often. I only know of a couple of these, but I think you'll find they exist. Next. Now I want to show you rapidly a small group of what I call schoolgirl paintings, the sort of thing that was taught in school. Here again you get that wonderful balance produced by the Bridge of Sighs. Next. this is not a painting. This is a paper cutout. This is all done. That's all one piece of paper. And the trick is not to separate it at all, so that it is from all one piece, except for the little birds. Everything there is part of the central piece. This is part of silhouettist art. Next. Now this is a watercolor, probably done by a schoolgirl, based upon a well-known print. Got some interesting details in it. This sort of low-covered Conestoga wagon and the mill, and a kind of sense, which you don't get in this photograph, of the terrible condition of the roads. Next. Now this is a painting on velvet. They had stencils of the various fruits which they used to draw an outline, and then putting these things in different combinations, painted them different colors. This was one of the standard things that a young girl was taught. Next. Another example of the same sort of thing, but a watercolor this time, on paper rather than on velvet. And I think a very nice one. Next. This is calligraphy. This is something that the boys tended to do. This is part of penmanship. This is making drawings out of penmanship. The trick was to have it all one line, not to lift your pen at any point. Next. Those of you that have read Huck Finn will remember that Huck at one point goes to village to visit a family named Grangerford. It's the family where the feud breaks out, you recall, and practically everybody gets killed. He has a wonderful description in that section of the memorial paintings that one of the Grangerford girls, who is now dead and gone, used to paint. The Weeping Willow, the Monument, the Mourning Family, and the Distant House are all very characteristic of this type. I'm devoted to this particular picture because it says, sacred to the memory of Mrs. Eunice Penny, who died, blank, age, blank, drowned by herself, July 1813. If ever there was a statement about, the sentimental period and the sheer pleasure of contemplating death and unhappiness, this is it. I am going to ask you to skip all of the next group until you come to the next barrier in the box. I have talked too much. But I want to show you in conclusion, and I have just 6 minutes, I guess. I want to show you in conclusion a group of pictures that are particularly important to me in terms of what they teach us about the way of life, about social history. This is an overmantel. This is a painted board that was over a fireplace, painted for this house. In 1735, it's one of the earliest landscapes in America. It was painted in the Upper Hudson Valley for the owner of the house. And let's look at one side now. Here is the owner. We know his name and his wife's name and his seven children. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and this one who's fallen off his horse, 7. Local Indians, they're probably their own slaves. This is a Dutch family. These are the Van Bergens. This is a Dutch farm in the Hudson Valley with absolutely true to form Dutch farm architecture. In the Openlucht Museum in Arnhem in Holland, you will see a barn identical to this. You will see hay barracks like these. You will see, now if we can have the next picture, you'll see wagons like this one and fences like this. In other words, here is a document about life in a particular racial group in this country that gives us details that no written documents that we have provide. Next.